This is the SNL Friday Night Speaker Meeting held at Upso Shopping Center, Room 120 in San Jose, California, on September 3rd, I hope, 1993. Tonight, our timid speaker is Jeff G., and our main speaker will be John E. The original recording and its copy are at the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. And please do not break the speaker's anonymity or any other person in AA's anonymity at the public level. Thank you very much.
Everyone, my name is Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. It's by the grace of God and program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sober today. Kind of stole that from my sponsor, but it's the truth. And I think, I believe I'll start sharing that at every time I share. Just so I don't forget. You know, I got 10 minutes and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to fill it or not. I spent all day by myself painting the kitchen, and by doing that, I was hanging out with two evils. One of them was the fumes from the paint, and the other one was with my head. And my head's been telling me all day what to say up here, and it's been my experience. I know better not to listen to that, because by the time I get up here and share, it's not going to be the same thing anyway. So, let's see what happens. I started drinking and using at the age of 14. I really don't want to go into too much with what it was like. I can tell you this, alcohol worked for me. And, you know, I tried, it was a problem for me. I tried to quit as soon as I started. And I know that. I lost the ability to control and enjoy my drinking as soon as I started. And one of the things I did to do that was I mixed it with drugs. And, that worked for a while. But it was all about controlling and enjoying my drinking. And, you know, they talk about crossing an invisible line. And you know what? Recently it was revealed to me that I remember, not exactly when, but I remember recalling when that happened for me. And when it did, I knew I was screwed. I just knew it. So I tried every angle I could to stop drinking and using. I moved, you know, it's all in the book. You can find me in the book. I share the book. It's all the same stuff. Moved, women, jobs, you name it, I've tried it. At the age of 22, I was introduced to the program Alcoholics Anonymous through 30-day treatment. And I went in there, I got a head full of knowledge, a lot of information, a lot of good information, and I got well real quick in 30 days. I got my job back, I got the woman back, and I was feeling pretty good. I made one vital mistake, and that was I never admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. You see, I thought I was a drug addict. And with that information, I came out. And I pretty much stayed away from drugs and alcohol for a considerable amount of time. What I'd do is I'd binge. And from the age of 22 to 28, actually 26, that's about what I did. I'd binge. I'd work out of town. Once I got away from the old lady and the kids, I would binge. And then I'd come back and I'd be responsible. And take care of business and play house. And every time I went out of town, I was all over. But I didn't have to worry about nobody to catch me. So what happened is a month before I was supposed to get married, I made a decision I wasn't going to get married. I was going to move to California. And I did that. And I was here for a while, had a good job, and hooked up with the lady. And things were going good. Life was good. And I was pretty much clean and sober. Well, maybe not. But life was good. And I crossed that invisible line again. And I knew I was screwed. And I was off on a run for a year and a half. Every day, on a daily basis, all day, all night long. I'd be up for 5 days, five nights, and sleep for two or three. And eventually affected my work. The relationship was gone. Job was gone. I was hanging out with some interesting people and interesting places. And I remember a day came along where I says, you know what, I just can't do this no more. And I came up with all the willpower I possibly could to quit. And I spent about two or three days in my room with the shakes and the heebie-jeebies and the creepy crawlies, and I swore up and down that I would never go through that again and that I would never drink or use again. And once that was over with, that next day I was feeling pretty good. And I drank and I used again. And I swore up and down that I'd never go back through that terror, the eebie-jeebies. So I made a decision I was going to be an alcoholic. I'd use and drink for the rest of my life. There's nothing I could do about it. And I continued to live that way for a while. And then I had a... I don't remember actually what happened, but I just took a look around me and I said, you know, I just cannot do this anymore. I had a moment of clarity. And it came to me. See, through all this, I forgot about Alcoholics Anonymous and I forgot about the 30-day treatment center I'd been through until I had this moment of clarity, and then it all came back to me. If I went into a treatment center and hooked up with Alcoholics Anonymous, which I did not do through the first treatment center. You see, I got well real quick, and I didn't need you guys, and I wasn't an alcoholic. And but what was revealed to me from the age of 22 to 28 was, you know what? I was an alcoholic, and no matter what, I couldn't quit on my own. So I made a few phone calls, and I went into work, and I told them that I couldn't work no more. I needed to get sober. And I moved up here from San Diego, went into the treatment center. And I knew that the money and the women and all those things didn't make me happy or keep me sober. So I made a commitment that I was going to find out just actually what the hell was wrong with me and just actually what the hell I could do about it or what needed to be done about it. Because if I wasn't sober and if I wasn't happy, nothing else mattered. So I was willing to give everything up, and that's what I proceeded to do. I gave up the job. I gave up the car. I gave up, well, I didn't have the woman. And I gave up all my old friends. And I moved to San Jose. And I plopped my butt in the seat of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat there and I listened with the greatest, as much as I could. And I hung on every word of people who shared from the podium. Sometimes that was good, sometimes that was bad. But for the people who shared the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, from the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that saved my life. I'd like to say I got a sponsor and worked the steps. Right off the bat, I didn't. I did pick up ashtrays. I did go to anywhere from 1 to 4 meetings a day. I did get into service. I secretaried meetings. I also shared from the podium a lot of crap. I felt that I was speaking the truth at the time, but I wasn't. And then coming up on my 2-year birthday, I made a decision to get into the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, to get a sponsor, and take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I hooked up with a guy that had... was familiar with the book, had some time under his belt. He shared from the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was the man for me. You know, I needed to get into that book. I needed somebody to explain to me. Now, I went to big book studies. I studied that book, and I read the steps, and I tried to figure them out. To the best of my ability, I tried to figure them out, and I tried to practice. I tried to do them the way I felt they were supposed to be done. And it wasn't until I hooked up with this guy and we sat down in his kitchen and he started taking me into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous the way he was taken through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous Were my eyes able to open up to the information that was in the book? Was I able to be pointed out the clear-cut directions of the book? You know, I tried to take a step from these boards. The steps aren't on the boards. Those are short versions of the step. Steps are clear-cut directions in the book how to take them, what to do, when to do, how to do it, why we do it. What happens when we do it? I didn't know that until I got sponsored. So we did this. And then one night I was going stark raving nuts. And there was a block between me and this guy that was taking me through the book. There was just a block there. And I remember laying on bed and I said, God damn it, if I got to go through this shit, you damn well better put somebody in my life that I can talk to, that can understand, that I can relate to. That next day, somebody was placed in my life. Whoa! And boy, we were on a ride then. I was serious. I wanted it. You know, I hooked up with this guy was presented in front of me the next day, and we ended up at the coffee shop. And I can honestly say that I felt the presence of God at that table. And I was suggested to me to do a few things. And I went home and I did them. And then once I started doing those things, I was intuitively guided and directed to do some other things. And I followed those directions and shit started happening. And what happened for me at that time is I truly came to believe for myself that a power greater than myself that was with me in my room by myself could restore me to sanity. What I experienced was that for the first time in my life, I was truly 100% free of fears, jealousies, revenge, resentments, judgments, you name it. I was truly free. And that hung around for a while. And then it started drifting away, and I had to get into the fourth step to find out what the hell was going on, why these things started drifting away. What was it that I was doing? And I got into the fourth step. And I wrote out my fourth step, and I took it to the sponsor, and we continued to go through the steps. And when I left his house that night, I was on ninth step. And where I'm at today is I've got a couple letters to write. On ninth step. But I'm in a place to where I'm learning how to practice these principles that I received, and I experienced these principles. I didn't know what honesty was until I experienced it through the first step. I didn't know what faith was until I experienced it in the third step. I didn't know what courage was until I experienced it through the fourth step. And once I had a feel for these things, you know, I had a relief through the process of the steps. But I found that I thought I was done, you know. Onward with my life, I was gone, you know. But what I experienced after a week and a half of running on that was, first of all, I don't rest on my laurels. And second of all, I need to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I experienced the pain behind not doing that. And pain's a good motivator, so I was able to do an inventory and identify what was going on and share with somebody, talk with somebody and get a clear understanding of what was going on to where I'm practicing principles in all my affairs to the best ability today because it didn't feel so great. And I also know the benefits of doing so because I've experienced it. So, we're out of time. I'd like to thank you all for having me.
Hi everybody, I'm John Eck and I'm an alcoholic. Most people call me Big John. I don't know why, but could have something to do with my size. It's a great honor for me to be chosen to come here and speak for the 50 minutes tonight. It's frightening. I'm nervous. I've never done this before. I've thought about it a lot today. And all I can do is tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I came from a family. I was born and raised back east in Poughkeepsie, New York. I came from a dysfunctional family, they're called nowadays. I believe my mother and my father were both alcoholics. I had an older sister, an older brother, and me. There were three of us. And I was 8 years younger than my brother. And he's probably the one most responsible for caring for me when I was younger. I loved and worshipped my older brother. I started drinking because in those days, when families weren't getting along, when parents weren't getting along, they didn't get a divorce. They lived under the same roof and hated each other and ruined everything around them. And who suffered but us, the kids? I can remember when I first tasted alcohol was a kid during the holidays. What holidays we would have at home? There was always they would have wine for the meal. It wasn't the good kind of wine that you needed a corkscrew to get out. It was a screw cap bottle, but it was pretty good screw cap wine. There were a few grapes in it at one time or another. And towards the end of the meal, I had the duty of going around and draining the wine glasses. And even at that age, when I was that young, I could tell that the wine did something for me. Gave me that warm feeling inside in my stomach. Made me relax. Helped me forget about my problems. And I can remember when I was a child, my mother would go her way, my father would go his way, and my brother, being his 8 years older than I was, he was gone. My sister was perhaps the smartest one of the bunch. She just she was gone as early and as often as she could. And I didn't have much contact with my sister growing up. But I can remember sitting at home, and it was before we ever had a television. We used to have a radio, and I'd be home at night, and I'd be scared. We couldn't afford a babysitter, and I don't know that anybody cared about a babysitter. I was always a big boy. I was always big enough. I could take care of myself. And I remember sitting at home at night, and I was frightened. I was scared. I was lonely. And I remember thinking to myself, God, as soon as I get old enough, I'm never going to be home. I'm never coming home. And you know, when I grew up, when I was a 14-year-old high school freshman, after the first football season, we had plans for some of the guys. There was a high school dance. This was a couple weeks after the end of the season, and we got our hands on a bottle of whiskey, some kind of whiskey, I don't know. And one of the guy's parents were gone for the evening, and there were about 4, 6, 8 of us. We're going to go over to Louie's house. I'll never forget Louie. And we went over to Louie's house, and it was my understanding we were going to go over and have a couple of drinks and loosen up before we went to the dance. And we got over to Louie's house, and I couldn't wait to open that bottle of whiskey. And for some reason, they wanted to save the whiskey. Now, that kind of gives you an indication of where I was coming from right then and there, 14 years old. Save it, my ass. Let's open it and drink it. That's why we bought it. No, we're not going to open it. And Louie handed me a bottle of gin. And I said, well, that's something. And I tore into that bottle of gin, and by golly, I did a hell of a job. And when I got to that high school dance, I was another Fred Astaire. God, I had them dancing feet. Man, was I something else. And then later on that night, we got back to Louie's house, and we did open the bottle, and we did finish the bottle off. And the next morning when I woke up, there was a big red blotch all over Louis' parents' white carpet in the family room, living room area, where Big John had barfed his guts out and left a nice bright red stain all over the carpet. Louis's been eternally grateful to me for that. That was the day I had my first hangover. I'll never forget the sickness I felt that day. I had the worst headache I've ever had in my life. I felt like the whole Russian army had spent the night in my mouth. It was putrid. It was just the goddamnedest feeling I'd ever gone through in my life. And I loved it. I loved it. Because I didn't remember anything from the night before. It was my first blackout. God, it was wonderful. I escaped. I finally escaped. I was free. And I couldn't wait for the next time. I just couldn't wait. And you know, the next time came, and the next time, and the next time, and the next time. And you know, right from the start, right from that little boy that used to walk around the Thanksgiving turkey dinner table and drink the wine out of those wine glasses, I was it. That was it for me. That was my answer to life. And when I was 14 years old, living in New York, you only had to be 18 to drink in New York. And when I was 14, 15, 16 years old, by God, I was bigger than most 18-year-olds. If I just had some kind of a mustache or something, I could have gone into a store and bought anything I wanted. But being resourceful, as we alcoholics are, that didn't stop me. And I continued to drink. And I, in my own little way, I did my geographics. My junior year in high school, I moved to Wisconsin with my brother and sister-in-law, and that was the opportunity of a lifetime. And after 3 months, it turned into trash. I came home. I reunited with my family. By that time, it was my family was my mother. My father had left, moved somewhere. He was still in the area. And I continued to drink. I was bigger then, and I could go into bars. I could go into a bar and sit down and have a drink. I never got into drugs because one thing my mother told me, I don't know if anybody here is old enough to remember a movie in days gone by called My Son John. And it was about somebody that got into heroin or some type of drug. Was that it? Was it heroin? And boy, my mother told me about that, and she just scared the bejesus out of me. And no matter what we went through, I always had to go to Mass on Sunday with my mother. I had to go to a Catholic grade school, and if there was a Catholic high school in Poughkeepsie, I'd have gone there too. And I didn't want to do it, and I didn't want to go to church, but I was too afraid of my mother not to. And it wasn't respect, and it wasn't out of desire to go and be an altar boy. I was just quite honestly scared. Went through high school. I finished my senior year in high school, and I kind of bounced around for a year, didn't know what I was going to do, and I ended up getting a scholarship to one of the world's most incredibly powerhouse football schools in this entire country. I had a chance for a scholarship to Notre Dame, and that kind of fell through. And I ended up going to a college by the name of Austin Peay State College in Clarksville, Tennessee. I had a full scholarship. Everything was paid for. They even gave me a room. And the only problem was that I remember once my freshman year, we came close to winning a football game. We only lost that one by 17 points. And I on Thanksgiving Day, every Thanksgiving Day, Austin Peay would play Fort Campbell, Kentucky, the home of the 101st Airborne. And they were graduates of West Point that decided they wanted to pick on little college kids. And I'll never forget my freshman year. They had a cannon. They would come and play in our stadium, and they had a cannon. Every time they scored, they'd fire that cannon. I was just praying, please, dear God, don't let anybody get hurt. Please, dear God, don't let anybody get hurt. I don't want to go in there because I don't want to get hurt. And they beat us so bad, they ran out of ammunition at halftime. They had to send the truck back and pick up a few more rounds of howitzers. And I don't remember if they had medics there or not. They didn't need them. We did. After a couple of years at Austin Peay, I could see I wasn't going to get drafted by any major NFL team, and I ended up going back home. It was not the place for me. I got back into alcohol. I got into drinking. I got a job at a bar, and I used to have to pay for my own drinks, and there were weekly paychecks of $1.39 because I had drank up my weekly salary. I went home, and that was a dead end. There was nothing there. There was nothing left in Poughkeepsie for me, and I was driving a produce truck, and it was a dead end. But I still had the booze, and I still had the dream, so I came to California. The golden shores of the Golden State. People in New York used to revere the sound of the name California. My God, bikini-clad women, sunshine all the time, Beach Boys, movie stars. Well, I came to California, all right. And I made it. I actually made it to California, and I had about $200-$300 on me. And the first thing we bought was a case of beer. Got an apartment. We paid 1 month's rent, me and my roommate, and we had an apartment in Hollywood. Hollywood. God, the big time. I've made it. Huh? Maybe we're going to run into some real stars. Well, we didn't run into anything. We went from Coors to Schlitz to down the road to we're drinking something called 102 Brew. God. It was horrible, but it was beer. And all you had to do was cool it off, and you were fine. And all this time, I knew I had somebody in San Francisco that played for the San Francisco 49ers. And he and I grew up together. And at the end of the month, when we didn't have any money left, we didn't have any rent money, we didn't have anything to buy any beer with, we had very little left. And I called my friend, and he said, "You can come up, and I'll take care of you. But don't bring any of your friends." Done. Because when you have an offer like that, you don't have any friends. You know, you forget very soon. I remember you, but I don't remember how I know you. And I came to San Francisco, and let me tell you something. If you're an alcoholic of my type, there is nothing, nothing in the world better than going out and getting drunk with somebody who's playing with the San Francisco 49ers. My God, we'd go places and we'd mingle with people, and walked into a bar one day and sat down next to Joe DiMaggio. I mean, that's the kind of places he hung out in. I wasn't used to that. And I drank. And I met my wife, and he introduced me to a profession of court reporting. And I went to court reporting school, I got married, and I became a court reporter. And I kept drinking, because God, I love to drink. And I had fun drinking. And I graduated from court reporting school, moved out of San Francisco, came down to Redwood City, Belmont, San Jose, eventually drinking all the time. And I got a job in court here in San Jose, and I've been here for 22 years in the same court. And finally, at one point, my brother had joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and he talked to me about it. And he moved to California, and just looking at him, at the change in him, I decided I wanted to come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I thought I might have a drinking problem. And I came, and I was here for several months. Didn't bother to get a sponsor because I'm not a real drunk like you guys are. I don't have a college degree, but I got a degree from the Academy of Stenographic Arts. And so I was a step above you folks, and I didn't need a sponsor, and the steps are all right if you're really sick, but you know, I was kind of okay. So it was a period of maybe 6 months, and then I just stopped coming to meetings, just gradually tapered off. And I had things to do. I was busy. I was feeling better. I was going here, I was going there, I was doing this, I was doing that. And pretty soon I stopped coming to meetings altogether. But you see, I didn't drink. I was afraid to take that drink. And Jim Bayard's sitting over here, and he speaks frequently here, and he says, you know, after today, you go out drinking, I'm going to ruin your drinking for the rest of your life, because you're going to go out, you're going to get drunk, and you're going to see my face. That's frightening. Jim is my sponsor, by the way. I want to let you know. Well, Jim wasn't here then, but it was a while. I'd picked up on something, and I was afraid to take that first one because I knew that's all it would take was that first drink. And it lasted about 2 months, 2.5 months. And we were coming into the holiday season, and I had met some new friends, and I had gone through some changes at work with the court system, and I had a new friend, and we were going to go out, and I knew in my heart of hearts that was the night. We were going to go out, and we were going to drink. And I have never been one or two drink person. It's always been and always will be balls to the wall. You know, just keep them flowing until I fall off this bar stool. Well, I went out that night, and I'll never forget when I told my wife we're going out. I was going out, I was going to meet Ed and another friend of mine. We're going to go have a few drinks. And she said, John, you know, it's been awfully nice these last several months. And I said, don't worry, it'll be okay. It'll be okay. Yeah, it's okay, all right. It didn't take me too long to get my first, my second drunk driving. And the indignity of the whole damn thing was these shithead highway patrolmen had the unmitigated gall to take me to my jail. In the basement of my courthouse. And I was pissed. And I let them know. And when they brought me into the holding area, Deputy Lanny Wu was sitting there and said, that's Big John. We don't care if it's Mother Teresa. Open up. But the one good thing is he let me have my cigarettes when I was in the holding cell waiting for somebody to get me out. And it continued to go down. And don't think for a minute that because I work in a court system for some judges that they're going to go easier on me. In fact, it's just the opposite. Because they want to make an example of me to you people that you will see that, no, they don't cut any slack for their own. And they didn't cut me any slack either. But this was back in the days before Mothers Against Drunk Driving and all these other groups that want us lynched. I didn't go to jail. I didn't spend any jail. But the indignity of being in jail a couple times was starting to work on me. But that didn't stop me. It didn't stop me. It didn't slow me down. It slowed me down for a couple of days. And I got an attorney, and everything was going to be okay. Well, it wasn't okay. And I paid my fine, and I worked things out, and I didn't get fired. In fact, the judge I was working for at that time kind of thought it was neat to have a drunk as a court reporter. You know, because I could give them the inside scoop on what things were like in a jail and how they treated people. And so I continued to drink. And it started going down and down and down, and you people know all about it. You start calling in sick. I don't feel good. I got a hangover. You don't tell the boss that. You don't tell the people at work that. So I got a cold. I got the flu. And there were days when I didn't have money. But it's incredible how resourceful we drunks are. I never went without a drink. I had charge accounts everywhere. I was welcomed in an awful lot of places. I drank with some of the judges, and I used to drink buddy-buddy around. And it finally came down to a point about, well, exactly 5 years ago, August 16th. August 15th, actually, my wife and I and my brother went out to my my 49er friend's 50th birthday party. And it was wonderful. It was up in San Francisco. And it was just incredible. And my brother, who was sober at the time and driving, what could be better? Have a chauffeur for an evening like that. And that provided my wife and I the opportunity to fight and argue all the way back from San Francisco about who was the bigger asshole. See? And we got in the house, and I knew I was going to win this argument because, you see, that was my brother. He helped raise me, and he was in my corner, and she was the winner. Well, guess what? We walked in the door. He walked in the bedroom, closed the door, locked the door, and didn't say a word to us. But that didn't stop us. We continued the fight into the bedroom. And finally we passed out. And I had to call in sick. The next day was a Monday. Because naturally you can't get that drunk and still function. As a court reporter, your hands are supposed to go 300 words a minute, but not when nobody's talking. I've had occasions like that. And so the next day I called in sick, and after I got absolved from any problems, I went out. My brother was sitting on the couch, and he was awake, and he was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And I walked out to my brother, and I said, "God damn it, Charles," I said, "you know I was right last night." See, you can't let it go. You can't admit defeat. You got to be right. Well, I'll tell you what happened. At that moment, my brother looked up at me. He was sitting on the couch. He looked up at me and he said, "John, you know what you've got to do." And at that moment, I knew what he was going to say. I knew what he was going to say. And I kept thinking, he said, "You've got to come back to AA." And I didn't have anything to say. I couldn't. "But you don't understand." But. Nothing. Nothing came out. I just hung my head because he was right. And at that moment, was my moment of surrender. I knew he was right. And I didn't have anything to... I didn't have an argument. And so I came to my first meeting that morning at Saturday Night Live over at Campbell High School. And I remember going into the meeting, and I remember the two ladies that were up here, the secretary and the chairperson, and I don't remember another person. And I sat in that room, and I cried. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. My mother was an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. I swear to God I'd never be an alcoholic. My brother was an alcoholic, and now here I was, a complete, total, utter failure. I was an alcoholic. Jesus Christ, I've seen thousands of alcoholics in my courtroom every year, and now I was an alcoholic. How am I going to wear my coat and tie to work again? How am I going to walk in front of my judge and let him know I'm an alcoholic? I sat there and I hung my head and I was ashamed and I was embarrassed and I didn't want to be there. And I don't remember anybody else in that room. Not another soul. The room was full, but I don't remember anybody in there. And when I walked out of that room, and I was walking across the parking lot in the back there, a man came running out and called my name. And I turned around. It was a man I had worked with for maybe 10, 12 years. He was in the district attorney's office, and he was somebody that I had admired for years. And he came up to me, and he gave me a hug, and he welcomed me. And he let me know that I was welcome. And he was my first sponsor. And he's the man that helped me take the steps. I remember looking at the steps when I was in that meeting and saying, "How in the name of God am I going to do these? What am I going to do? How am I going to tell my wife how unfaithful I've been? How am I going to make amends for being such an incredible shithead for all these years? I can't do that." And thank God I had a brother who sat down and talked to me and let me know how I was going to do it. and how I was going to start taking care of it, and not to worry about step four until you get to step four. You start with step one. And I had already done that. I admitted I was an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't relish the idea of spending the rest of my life without ever having another Manhattan. God, a Manhattan. Huh? I was a court reporter on a case of the man that murdered those seven people at ESL. Seven people this asshole murdered because he was jealous and wanted to make a statement. Well, after I took testimony of two coroners all one day, was that wonderful. And then I had a second triple Manhattan. And then I had a third. And after I finished my fourth, I figured, Jesus Christ, I better go to bed. I got to work tomorrow. Because we weren't done yet. And that was one of the times when I walked in the courtroom and my hands were going 300 words a minute. And the attorneys weren't even in there. And I started thinking, oh my God, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do this? Please, dear God, there's TV cameras around here. There's people. What am I going to, please. If you do this for me, I'll never drink again. And do you know what? The public defender, his name was Gregory Parascu, and he walked in and sat down, and when we started, the case was called, and he started his examination of the second coroner, and he talked so slow, I could have written it out in longhand, you know? And there were two Iranian coroners. There's nothing like reporting an Iranian coroner. Two of them are just that much more fun. Well, I'll tell you what, after about half an hour, I started saying, well, you know, I really meant what I said. I'm not going to have another drink until Friday. And as far as the Manhattans, okay, I'll wait till the weekend, but, you know, maybe a beer or two. I did manage to wait till the weekend before I started. That's the kind of alcoholic I was. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't, no matter what the situation, no matter what the activity, I could not say no. And after I met Joe at the old Saturday Night Live, and I had surrendered and I made up my mind I was going to get sober, my brother told me, John, you don't look at 10, 15, 20 years down the road, you look at tomorrow. You stay sober one day at a time. You can do that. You can do that. I thought, yeah, maybe I can. Maybe I can. Today's my first day. And I stayed sober that day. And my brother stayed here with me for a couple of days, maybe a week. And I made it through a week. And I asked Joe to be my sponsor. He's a man I loved and respected. And he took me through the steps, the 12 steps. And he worked with me, and he worked with me, and he nurtured me. And I got sober and sober and sober. And I just celebrated 5 years this month. In that 5 years, I like to think that I've grown considerably. I have grown considerably physically because when I came in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I weighed 400 pounds. I couldn't cross my legs if I had help. I can remember sitting there thinking, my God, all I want to do is sit down on a chair and cross my legs and not have to grab one leg and yank it up and flop around on the floor and roll around and make an ass of myself. After I got sober, I was able to quit smoking. I quit smoking after about 7-8 months when I was comfortable with not drinking. I quit smoking. I was able to do that, and that was something I wanted to do. And after I quit smoking, I figured, well, what's the next step? Fatso. That gives me an idea. Maybe I'll go on a diet. And I did. And I was able to use the steps and principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to go on a diet. It wasn't less than 2 years after I got sober, my wife left me. That was a lot of fun. I got sober. I guess I got miserable, too. And we had a fight, and I invited her to leave. And after 20-some years of marriage, she was gone. And for the first time in my life, when I went away to college at Austin Peay, I had a roommate with me when I left. When I came to California, I had somebody with me when I came to California. When I went to Wisconsin, I had somebody with me when I went to Wisconsin. I've I've never lived alone. Can you imagine the fear of living alone? And I had a son at home with me. And through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to do it. My son, believe it or not, didn't starve to death. In fact, if some of you people see him, you'll recognize him. He's 3 inches taller than I am. His feet are bigger than mine. Looks down on me, and he's only 17 years old. Maybe I fed him a little too much. The house didn't go to pot, to coin a phrase. It was through people in this program that I had help me. I hired them to paint the house, to fix the house up. The house actually improved. And you know what? My wife and I got together because she wanted to somebody to help decide who was going to get custody of my son. I have 2 daughters who were away in college at the time. And who was going to get the house and whatnot. So we went to a counselor that one of my judges had recommended. And after having a session separately, of course, my wife went one day and I went another day and I brought my son with me. And the counselor said, you know, I really think I can put this marriage back together again if you're willing to try. And I said, well, I've never said that I want to get a divorce. And after a couple of sessions, she moved back into home with me. And on September 10th, we're going to celebrate our 27th wedding anniversary. I've been able to do that through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gotten sober. I've gotten responsible. I'm no angel, in case anybody gets the wrong idea. No saint. I'm an alcoholic. I have my family back now. And what has happened is, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I still have my job. The judge I was working for early on in the program was elevated to Superior Court. And I went with him to Superior Court because he was the kind of judge that I absolutely loved working for. The man never made a decision that embarrassed me, never made a decision that I could not live with. The only problem was that when we went to Superior Court after a couple of months, our first assignment was juvenile hall. And one day at the end of one of our trials that we had, I looked up and one of the boys was sitting there crying. And he reminded me of my son. And I started crying. I couldn't help it. Couldn't hold it in. I couldn't be tough. Some people say I couldn't be strong. I couldn't do it. And every day from that time after, I sat in that courtroom and I cried. I wondered, where the hell are the people that care? Where are the people that care for these children? Where's somebody who gives a damn? We wonder why this society is going down the toilet. Look at what we're doing. Look how we treat our children. I couldn't do it anymore, so I told John Herlihy that I had to leave. I was going back to municipal court. I can deal with the murderers. I can deal with the rapists. I can deal with the drunks, I can deal with the dregs of society, but I can't deal with the children. So I came back to municipal court, where I am to this day. What I've managed to do is one of my daughters brought a girlfriend home one day. Her mother had passed away, and her father was going to San Quentin for being arrested one too many times for drunk driving. Kind of, my daughter's the one that used to bring cats home all the time by the neck. You know, look what followed me home. Can I keep it? Well, she didn't exactly have her arm around Marianne's neck, but Marianne's still living at my house. And we're still caring for Marianne. She's going to be 21 next month. Short while later, a friend of my son's came, and he needed a place. He didn't have a father who cared. He had no idea where his mother was. And he needed a place. And I'm going, oh, my God. You know, and I'm starting a home for wayward children, my own and others. And so now Paul is living with me in our home. He's 18 years old, and he just passed the last class that he needed to get his high school diploma. He got a job. God, he got a job. Jesus Christ, I can't believe it. I was able to answer the phone one night, and somebody asked for Paul, and I said, he's at work. W-O-R-K, work. God, he did it. He got a job. And he's going to start becoming responsible, or I'm going to kill him. What I've gotten out of Alcoholics Anonymous is the ability to do something like that, to care for people, to care for my children, to care for somebody else's children, to care for my wife. Life is different now. I wake up in the morning, I don't feel that hangover anymore. We all know what a hangover is like. We all know what a super hangover is like. You know? I get in my car and I drive it. I drive it at night, after dark. And you know, if I see a highway patrolman behind me, I don't get all shook up. I don't care. The worst thing he can do is give me a speeding ticket. Maybe an equipment violation. Maybe he can hassle me somehow. But he can't arrest me. Because I'm not going to have anything on me, or I'm not going to have anything in me that is going to give him cause to want to take old Big John back to his own jail. I spent my last night in the Santa Clara County Jail as an inmate. In order for me to help pay back the program of Alcoholics Anonymous every other Thursday night, I go to the main jail. I drive down there, and I walk in the door, and they open the door and welcome me with open arms. And they let me go up to the seventh floor, and they let me conduct an AA meeting. And I go up there, and I see the people. Some of them I see in court. Some of them I haven't. But I get to talk to them. And you know what? And it's been shared here from the podium before. Not everybody that drinks gets in trouble. But I'll tell you what. All those people in that room have one thing in common. There isn't a goddamn one of them that wasn't drinking when they got arrested. Not a one of them. That kind of tells us something. That kind of lays it all out there. And I'd be willing to bet that of all the people in this room, an easy 75% of us, whenever we got in trouble, we had been drinking. There's proof positive how wonderful the effects of alcohol can be on us. You know? I sit in a courtroom every day. And I watch these people come in. And I can tell you this, honest to God, 75% of those people are going to go to jail. And of those 75% of those people, the 75% of the people I deal with are in because of drugs and or alcohol. They're supporting our system of justice. A drunk driving right now, a drunk driving case today, is $1,236 fine, 10 days in jail, on and on and on and on and on. Drunk drivers are supporting me. They're paying my salary. Can you imagine that? And it goes up from there. Your second one's more, your third one's more, and your fourth one, they've got a suite at San Quentin reserved for you. That's the way things are going, folks. Drunk driving's the easiest case for the district attorney to prove. They have some of the most feeble, incompetent, horrible men and women that you've ever seen in a courtroom. And they'll take a drunk driving out and get a conviction 9 out of 10 times. That easy. Because we, alcoholics are not popular people. Are not popular people in the community with juries. I don't know how they find these people to be on juries. But they all have this real hatred for people that drink and drive. Where the hell they find them, I don't know. They found them for me, too. You know? And I sit there on a daily basis and I just shake my head. I can't believe it. Because there is a solution. There's a solution right here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't charge dues. They don't charge a fee to come in. You can walk in that front door at any time. You don't have to be afraid to be here. You don't have to be afraid to get sober. You can. I can. I did it. I got sober. God damn it. I picked up a 5-year chip last weekend. 5 years of sobriety. One day at a time. What being sober has permitted me to do is, at the very end of August, I took a trip back to my hometown of Poughkeepsie, New York. You see, my father died a month after I graduated from high school. And I'd never been home sober. And I don't have any family there anymore. I've got some friends. And a friend of mine wanted to go home, and I decided to go with him. And I wanted to go to my father's grave, and I wanted to make amends to my father. I wanted to have a chat with them. Because like people, Woody chaired the men's meeting last Saturday, and I don't know if you talked about your feelings with your father, but some people didn't get up and talked about their relationships with their father. And I don't know what it is about men and their fathers in this program. But I had to go home and make amends to my father. I could finally put it to rest. And when I went to the cemetery where I knew he was buried, they couldn't find him. There's nothing like going to a cemetery where you know your father is buried and not finding him. And it's frustrating and it's painful and it's humiliating when you find out you're at the wrong cemetery. You know? Maybe sober, but you ain't well. Thank God I followed the principles of AA and didn't raise a stink. And when I finally did get to the cemetery, I had a chance to talk to my father. And I said some prayers. And I said goodbye to him. Finally able to speak to him.
I was feeling the most frustrated and the most hurt. I found an AA meeting. I went to that meeting, and I didn't know anybody in that room, but they all knew me. They were there for me. They gave me support. And they talked to me. They loved me. And they helped me get through an experience like that. And the next day I went to an AA meeting. And the next day, and I was able to stay sober. I was able to stay sober in my hometown. And when I left, and when I drove out of the city of Poughkeepsie, New York, I knew right then and there I would never go back. You see, because Poughkeepsie is not my home anymore. San Jose, California is my home. It's where my friends are, where my family is. It's where my program of Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's where the people that love me are. And while I still have a lot of friends back, I call it back home, I finally put that part of my life behind me. And I've come here with renewed vigor. This is the most awesome program in the world. And for anybody here that may go out and drink again, and there will be others, maybe me, maybe anybody, I just beg you, please, please, don't be too proud to come back in here. The vast majority of us don't get it the first time. A lot of us don't get it the first time. And if we don't come back, we're not going to get to sample the miracle, the joy of being sober. I used to say, how can anybody have fun if you can't drink? How many of you have thought about that? My God, I'll never get drunk again. I'll never pass out again. I'll never black out again. God, that's fun, isn't it? What a great time I had in jail last night. Huh? God, I can't wait to go see that ugly judge in a black dress. Huh? I can't wait for him to give me a $1,300 fine and a kick in the ass. God, that's great fun, isn't it? Yeah. Well, let me tell you what's fun. Fun's going to an AA convention in Honolulu, Hawaii. Fun's going to that convention and going to the prime rib buffet and bringing tears to the eye of the maitre d'. The man finally surrenders and knows he's bought the ranch. So I'll guarantee I get my money's worth. I know Jim does. Yeah. And I know what it's like to have to walk by the Mrs. Fields cookie store on the way home, too. That's fun. Huh? And I remember it all. I remember it all. Remember going to the beach. I remember going to Hanama Bay. That's fun. And then you get to come home. And a couple weeks later is a convention in Yosemite Park. That's a place that God put on this country. God put in the state of California. I don't know if he meant it to be here, but it's here. And it's within driving distance. And I got to go there twice. My God, that's a special place. It's a special place to go when you're sober, because you can remember, you can look at the beauty, you can look at the grandeur, and if you've ever been to Yosemite and you have problems believing there's a God, maybe you need some help. Maybe you need some help. You can come talk to me, maybe I can talk to you and recommend a priest or somebody, because I'll guarantee you, if you've ever been to Yosemite, that is God's country. There's so much to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's so much to do sober. I'll never be able to pay back Alcoholics Anonymous for what it's given to me. Not ever. But I can try. I can try by being an example of what sobriety can do for somebody. And if that's all I can do, then that's what I'll continue to do. It's given my wife back. I'm not sure if I'm, you know. No, I can't say that. We still get along. We get along quite well. We have our problems. Anybody that's been married 27 years, you either got to be crazy or, you know, you're going to have problems. I've got three wonderful kids. I'm able to help people in the program now, like they were able to help me. Like I say, I'll never be able to pay you people back. I don't know all of you. I love all of you, and I thank you for being here. Thank you.